The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Talk about the Four Noble Truths today. And I thought I'd also, you know, not necessarily try to finish a Dharma talk. sometimes I feel like when I, you know, have a certain amount of information I want to get through in an evening, there's not too much time for questions and discussions. And so I thought I'd take a hint from some of my Burmese teachers who will start a Dharma talk and then they'll just talk for however long. And then they say, okay, we're done for today. The Dharma talk will continue the next day or the next week, whatever it is. And so they would just give this one Dharma talk that I heard. I think it went over, you know, 5, 6, 7 talks or something like that. So I just thought I'd just explore the Four Noble Truths, give a little bit of an overview of the Four Noble Truths, and then begin exploring some various aspects of the Four Noble Truths, but also just allow as much opportunity for questions and discussion as there is interest for. And from time to time, I'll actually even pause and say, okay, you know, I've got more to say, but, you know, let's just check in and see if there's any questions. And feel free to raise your hand if there's a question while I'm speaking. So I thought I'd actually start by reading a comic, a cartoon. I found this as I was going through my notes about the Four Noble Truths. I found this in my notes, and so I thought I'd share it with you. This is Pearls Before Swine. If you're not familiar with Pearls Before Swine, it's like this, you know, these communities of mice and pig and alligator and zebra. That's it. And they all, you know, do their things and they kind of interact and whatnot. So in this one, Mouse is sitting at a desk writing a letter. And here's what the letter says. Dear Life, I am writing to you to express my dissatisfaction. First, I didn't ask to be here. You put me here. That started us off on a bad foot. Given that rocky start, I'd think you'd strive to be a good host. But no, you fill this place with unpleasant surprises. As if that weren't enough, at some point I apparently ceased to exist in a manner that is most likely shocking, painful, and tragic. Can you say rip off? Please provide a refund. And then Pig walks up, and Mouse shows him the letter and says, where do you send one of these? Where does one send these? So, you know, Mouse is confronting suffering. Stress, dissatisfaction. It's like, I'm writing to express my dissatisfaction, you know? So there is dissatisfaction in our lives. This is essentially what the Buddha also found, you know? But instead of writing a letter, the Buddha decided to say, what can I understand about this? What can I learn? Is it possible? Is it possible to be free of this dissatisfaction, the stress, the suffering, this unease? So this question of suffering really motivated the Buddha. I'd like to describe a little bit about his life before he came to this understanding around the Four Noble Truths. He was living in a pretty opulent situation. I think his father was it's often said that he was a prince and that his father was a king. But I think it was more local. It wasn't like the king of a large territory, but more kind of like a local kingship. But he lived a pretty good life. He had several different palaces, you know, where he could retire in the winter when it was hot in the lower territory. He had a good place to go, and he had, you know, lots of flowers and beautiful things and musicians that would entertain him. He basically had a pretty good life. living in the palace. But he was a contemplative. He was thoughtful. And he saw, you know, things grow old, they get sick, they die. And that's not a very satisfying existence. And actually, what he says, I think this is interesting, because this is kind of the motivation of his search, in a way. He said, before my enlightenment, being myself subject to birth, aging, ailment, death, sorrow, and defilement, I sought after what was also subject to those things. And this is what we do, actually. You know, in our lives, we are subject to aging, illness, death, and we try to find happiness by somehow connecting with other things, experiences, relationships. We try to find happiness by connecting outwards with other things. This is our habit. This is our pattern. This is a human pattern. It's not personal, that we think we're going to find happiness by constructing a world in which things are as we like it. And actually, the Buddha had a pretty good life. You know, he had a pretty good life in the palace. And yet he saw, well, I'm still subject to aging, sickness, and death. And the happiness that I'm seeking in things that are also subject to aging, sickness, and death. Where aging, sickness, and death can also be understood to be the kind of the life cycle of all things. I mean, if we're trying to find happiness in having material things around us, those material things eventually decay. If we're trying to find happiness in relationships, we're placing our happiness on another person who is also subject to aging, illness, and death. And so he goes on. He says, then I thought, why, being myself subject to birth, aging, ailment, death, sorrow, and defilement, do I seek after what is also subject to those things? So he had that question, you know, what is there another way? Is there a way to seek a happiness? Is there an ending to this sense of life as a ripoff, basically? Can we come to an understanding where that sense of dissatisfaction, of sorrow, of grief, of unease isn't there anymore? And so he decided to leave home and go off in search of an answer to that question. So this was what motivated his search, this question of dissatisfaction, stress, unease. The word in Pali that is usually used for that set of terms is dukkha. You've probably heard that term if you've been coming here for long. Dukkha. So he's asking, what is this dukkha? Is it actually something that is inherent in life, or is it possible to be free of it? That was his question. And so he went off in search of teachings, and in the time of the Buddha, there were a lot of spiritual seekers and teachers. And so the first few teachers he came across were teachers of deep states of concentration, of settledness of mind. And part of the exploration, the understanding, was to settle the mind down, let go of all the thinking, become really quiet and still. The mind gets very blissful and peaceful. The body tends to disappear. The body can, like, you can be like there's no body there. The body can feel like it's filled with light, or just actually not be there. So there's no pain in the body. And so the Buddha learned these practices to put himself into these states, and he could at will put himself into these very blissful states, make himself feel no pain whatsoever. So no suffering in those states of concentration. But then the concentration would end. He would come out of those states. I think in some of those states that he learned, he could put himself into almost a state of suspended animation for up to 7 days. It said that you can survive for 7 days without any food or water or going to the bathroom or anything by kind of slowing your metabolism down. So he had that capacity. He could do that for 7 days. But, you know, he can't do it for longer than 7 days because the body is a body. It needs things. And so coming out of that, he recognized, I'm still subject to all of the pain of the body. I'm still subject to the mental distress here. So this isn't answering my question. And he asked his teachers, is this all you teach? This being able to put yourself into these spaces. And they said, yes, you know everything that I know at this point. He's like, well, this isn't what I'm looking for. And so he went off to look in other places, to do other kinds of explorations. And he began practicing some other kinds of practices that were available in his day, severe ascetic practices. The concentration practices can be looked at as practices of allowing the mind to become very peaceful, very blissful. The ascetic practices are practices of depriving the body of air, of food. He would spend time holding his breath for as long as he could. There's this one sutta where he describes, I stopped my ears and my nose and stopped breathing, and painful, racking feelings went through my body when I tried to stop breathing. He described how thin he got by only eating a little bit of food. And he tried to get down. He got down to the place where he was only eating one grain of rice a day. And he described his body. And this is so visceral for me. He said, when I touched my belly, I could feel my backbone. That's how emaciated he got. He nearly died from starvation. And again, he realized, this doesn't seem to be the way. This is not freeing myself from suffering. And so he took some nourishment and he regained his strength. And at some point in that process of regaining his strength, it said that he had a memory of a time when he was either a boy or a young man. It's not so clear actually how old he was, but he had a memory of sitting under a tree in the shade, watching his father do a kind of a ritual planting in the spring. Kind of the, you know, what the king does at the beginning of the planting season. So he was sitting under this tree and he spontaneously fell into a state of concentration. Very wholesome, peaceful experience. And in remembering that, he thought, you know, I wonder if that is the way. I wonder if there's something there. Now, the states of concentration that he'd practiced earlier with his teachers, you know, coming to those spaces of just complete calm and bliss and being able to put himself in the space of suspended animation for like 7 days at a time, those were very similar in a way to this kind of concentration that he remembered that he'd stumbled into. There were some similarities between those concentrations. And so there's a little bit of question about, you know, why is it that he didn't notice or understand that that was the way earlier? And I think partly, there's no real good answer for this, except that's given in the text, as far as I can tell. But the kind of my exploration or my understanding of this is that the teachers who were teaching the concentration that he was exploring earlier in his practice, they were teaching that as an end in itself, that the state of concentration itself was the goal of that practice. And in this memory of the sitting under the tree and falling into this spontaneous, peaceful, quiet state of concentration, my understanding is that he kind of realized that that concentration could be used as a tool to explore this question of suffering. That the mind that gets quiet and still can be used to understand things, to explore things. So that's my understanding of the difference, that in the earlier concentration he was practicing, he was doing it as an end in of itself. In this later time, he began to think of the concentration as a tool to support his exploration. And so he, with that idea in mind, he began using the concentration, settling his mind in concentration, and then exploring this question of suffering. What is suffering? How is it caused? How can it possibly come to an end? And I think the question of what suffering is itself was a key piece of this exploration. And so he came to a deep understanding and found for himself that there is an end. There is an end to suffering. Now, this understanding, I think, depends very crucially on what is meant by dukkha, what is meant by suffering. And so I'll just talk about this very briefly right now, because this is, I think, a lot of what I want to explore today, is just what exactly does it mean? What exactly does this dukkha mean? So the suffering that the Buddha found could come to an end isn't the suffering of unpleasant physical experience. The Buddha himself had a bad back, and there were times in his teaching career that he had to say to some of his attendants or monks, you know, I can't give the Dharma talk today, my back hurts too much, I need to go lie down, why don't you give the Dharma talk? You know, so he experienced physical pain. So the suffering that can come to an end here is not the suffering of bodily pain. It's not the suffering that we often call suffering, you know, this is the actual physical pain. Instead, what he was referring to that could come to an end is reactivity, essentially a mental reaction to what is happening in our lives. If physical pain is happening, there's also usually a mental reactivity to that. If we are feeling pain in our knee, there's often a sense of, how can I get rid of this? How can I fix this? How can I change this? What's wrong? Do I need to go to a doctor? Do I need to have surgery? So there's, some of those things may need to happen. I'm not saying that we simply let our knee, you know, fall apart. But there is a mental suffering and struggle happening around with that through that reactivity. That we don't simply notice, oh, our knee is hurting. Wonder if there's something that needs to be done about that in that kind of calm way. It's like, there's something wrong with my knee. What can I do about it? How can I fix it? We get reactive. We get panicked. We get stressed about it. That is the piece that the Buddha said can come to an end. That mental reactivity, whether to physical experience or mental experience. And I'll talk more about that in a little while. So in understanding the suffering, in understanding this question of what suffering is, he saw in his own mind how it can be dismantled and the way that he could actually express to people, and you can do this for yourselves. So in his recognition of this possibility, he realized, wow, this would be helpful for people to know this. And yet at the same time he thought, you know, what I've discovered here is pretty subtle. And the kind of hook that I found in my mind that I've been able to release, it's pretty subtle. I don't know whether people would understand me if I taught this. And that would be vexing if I tried to teach and nobody understood me. So maybe I won't teach. But fortunately for us, he changed his mind. It said that some deity came and visited him and said, no, you have to teach. So, you know, we can think of that perhaps as a kind of a, you know, another reflection that arose in his mind. You know, there will be some people that might be able to understand this. And so he reflected in his mind about who might understand this teaching that he had. And his thoughts went to a group of 5 monks that he spent quite a bit of time with in the ascetic practices, doing these severe practices that deprived the body. And they had abandoned him when he started to eat again, because he had been kind of their leader of, you know, it was like he was the most able to follow these severe ascetic practices, and they were kind of waiting with bated breath, saying to themselves, well, if he discovers anything, we'll be the first to know. And then he started eating, and they said, well, he's obviously given up the true path. We'll just go off and be by ourselves. But he, in thinking about them, he thought, you know, they might understand. And so he undertook quite a long journey to go find them. He, I think it was, you know, it was quite a long distance. He probably walked for at least several weeks, if not a couple of months, to get to the place where he knew they were staying. And so when he came upon them, at first they kind of had this conversation among themselves. They said, you know, there's that Gautama. You know, he didn't stay with the true path. We'll ignore him. But they found they couldn't ignore him because his bearing, his demeanor was so peaceful and radiant. They could tell something had happened. But still, they tried to ignore him. And he came up to them and he said, you know, I found something you might want to know. You know, I found this path of release. And they, you know, were still trying to ignore him. And he said, you know, have you ever heard me talk like this before? And they said, no, we haven't. And he said, well, you know, maybe you want to pay attention. Maybe there's something here for you. And so they did listen. And what he talked to them about in that very first teaching that he gave was the Four Noble Truths. This was the teaching that he kind of crystallized or came to an understanding and said, this is kind of the core, this understanding, the Four Noble Truths, this is the core of what I learned that night when I deeply understood into suffering. And he is, in subsequent teachings, he has said that everything that he taught, every single thing that he taught could be seen as an elaboration on some aspect of the Four Noble Truths. So everything that the Buddha taught was somehow related to these simple truths. They are the truth of suffering or stress, the truth of the cause of suffering or craving. Craving being the cause of suffering. And I'll go through these in a little more detail in a bit. The truth of craving, the truth of the cause of suffering, the truth that it is possible for suffering to come to an end, the truth of the ending of suffering, and then the truth of the path leading to the ending of suffering. So there's a few things to kind of notice about these four truths. They're all structured around dukkha. They're all structured around this question of suffering. And at one point, the Buddha, in talking to some of his monks, picked up a handful of leaves in the forest floor from the forest floor and said, "Which is greater, the number of leaves in the forest or the number of leaves in my hand?" And you think, well, is this a trick question? You know, obviously the number of leaves in your hand is fewer than the number of leaves in the forest. And he was using it kind of as a kind of a visceral sense. He says, just the same way, what I teach is like this handful of leaves. What I know is like the leaves in the forest. But he says, I don't teach you everything that I know. And why don't I teach you everything that I know? Because it's not relevant to this question of ending suffering. So he really focused on this question of ending suffering. This is our path to liberation. This is our path to freedom and well-being. He simplified it for us so that he said, this is what you need to know. And it's in these, it's kind of contained in this teaching on the Four Noble Truths. So these Four Noble Truths are structured around this question of dukkha. And if we look at them, there's two pairs, kind of. There's the truth of suffering and the truth of the cause of suffering. There's the truth of the end of suffering and the truth of the path leading to the end of suffering. So the first two, if we think about the first two, the second truth, the second noble truth, the truth of the cause of suffering is the cause. You know, there's a cause and effect relationship. The cause of suffering is the cause, and the effect is the suffering. And likewise, in the second pair, there's also a cause and effect relationship. There's the possibility for the ending of suffering, and there is a cause for that. It's not random. It's not random in our lives that suffering is created, that suffering comes up. There's a cause for it. And it's not random in our lives that we can possibly find the end of suffering. There is a cause for that ending of suffering. And so the Buddha proposed, first of all, that there are things that we can do. You know, that first of all, in our normal minds, there are things that are happening that are creating the suffering in the first place. And then there are things that we can do, engage in, that will help us to become free of that suffering. So that's one thing, is just recognizing this cause and effect relationship. These Four Noble Truths are kind of stated in a framework of a medical model, that if we think about the suffering being the illness, the Buddha, kind of as a doctor, said, okay, yep, here's the illness. This mental reactivity, this is the illness of the human condition. And its cause is basically craving. This craving here meaning wanting things to be other than they are. So when we want things to be other than they are, we react. The reactivity is born out of wanting things to be different. Either things are pleasant, we like them, we want them, we want to hold on to them, they fade, they fall away, we get frustrated with that, or they're unpleasant, we don't like them, we want to get rid of them. So we're kind of in this continual battle or continual arranging, rearranging of our experience to try to construct things the way we'd like them to be. We're rarely able to just be with things as they are, just meeting things as they are without reactivity. Now, this non-reactivity doesn't mean non-action. It doesn't mean that we are sitting like a lump on the log for the rest of our lives, just, oh, things as they are, you know. It's like, you know, if you're sitting on a bus stop, you know, next to a busy intersection, and you see a child run out into the road, you know, the movement there is not, oh, things as they are, a child is running into the road. No, you get up and you act out of compassion for the danger of that child and the suffering, you act. It's not out of reactivity, not out of, well, there may be some fear that comes up, but it doesn't have to be. It can be out of compassion. It's not, so there's a difference in acting out of compassion, of kindness, than there is out of reacting out of aversion, of greed, of delusion. And this is the piece that the Buddha was really pointing to, that this reactivity is this illness of our minds. And it's caused by not being able to be at ease with things as they are. So this is the illness and the cause of the illness. And then the prognosis for this illness is, the Buddha says, yep, possible to be cured. You have to take the prescription. You have to take the medicine. The medicine is the Fourth Noble Truth, the path leading to the end of suffering, the Noble Eightfold Path. Eight practices, eight tools for living a life that will help us to understand the suffering. So this medical model gives us a sense of these Four Noble Truths. You know, it's not that somebody can, you know, we can have a doctor give us the prescription. And the doctor can write out the prescription for us and hand it to us. But we have to do something with that. We have to fill the prescription. We have to take the medicine for ourselves. We can't just kind of sit in a space and hope for some kind of transmission. It's got to be acted on. And that's the other key piece, I think, about these Four Noble Truths. The Buddha didn't just simply put them out there and said, these are truths, believe them. He said, these need to be acted on. The noble truth of suffering is meant to be understood. We need to understand our suffering, not in an intellectual way, not in a thoughtful way, although it's helpful to be thoughtful about our suffering, But the understanding that the Buddha was pointing to is this turning towards, meeting, being with, rather than trying to do something to fix or change our suffering, to meet it, to be with it. This exploration begins to lead us to understand how suffering is caused. So in our own minds, we begin to understand that as we see our suffering, as we sit with our suffering, meet it, we begin to see where we are not at ease with things as they are. So we begin to understand that craving and how it plays into the suffering. So this understanding of suffering begins to lead us to deeply recognize, explore, understand for ourselves the cause of suffering. So we begin to notice that connection ourselves through this understanding. The second noble truth, the truth of the cause of suffering, is the Buddha said we need to let go of that. We need to let go of craving. We need to abandon it. This is also part of our practice. This is a lot of where our exploration happens. You know, we pay attention to our suffering. We see how we're holding on. Sometimes we can let go. Sometimes we can recognize we're holding on and actively say, yeah, okay, I can let go of that. But I'd say more often what we see is that we're holding on and we have no idea how to let go. It's just, it feels like it's just tight. I remember sitting in meditation at sometimes on the 3-month course, and it's like, wow, I see this holding. If I'd let go if I knew how. I have no idea how to release this holding. It's like this knot of tension that was so tight that there was no way for me to consciously release it. So the exploration at that point is just allowing. Again, it kind of becomes that understanding. Understand that holding. That craving itself feels like suffering. So in our turn, we need to understand that. And over time, my exploration of that, I have seen so many times, the willingness to just simply be with that kind of holding allows it to begin to let go of itself. And so the letting go of this second noble truth may be more of a kind of a allowing it to release on its own through being willing to be present for it, being willing to be attentive for it. The third noble truth, the Buddha says, is meant to be realized. The ending of suffering links up with the second noble truth, because the definition of the ending of suffering is the ending of craving, the ending of that wanting. So the abandoning, the letting go of that craving takes us to that freedom, takes us to that place of realizing the ending of suffering. That's the very ending of craving itself is the ending of suffering. The fourth noble truth, the path leading to the ending of suffering, the eightfold path, and I'll just name the pieces now: wise understanding, wise intention, wise speech, wise action, wise livelihood, wise effort, wise mindfulness, wise concentration. Those are the tools that the Buddha suggested we cultivate. The cultivation of these tools is what, in their turn, allows us to actually follow the actions of the Four Noble Truths. The cultivating wise understanding, wise intention, the ethical conduct and the activities of around meditation, those are what allow us to begin to understand suffering. So these Four Noble Truths are kind of a spiral. You know, it's they feed back on each other. The more we understand of the teachings, the more we can apply the teachings, and then the more we understand the teachings. We gain a First, we start with an intellectual understanding and begin by exploring, okay, what does it mean to be mindful of suffering? How do I do that? And as we do that, we begin to see some benefits. We begin to actually recognize, oh, this is helpful. Actually, I see how this is helpful. It doesn't actually take that long. In my first few months of meditation practice, or mindfulness practice, actually more than meditation practice, because I didn't do sitting meditation for the first 3 months of my mindfulness practice. I just explored mindfulness in my daily life. And in that first few months, I began to really clearly understand that it was possible to be mindful of suffering. In my case, I was exploring anger. And to learn deeply, understand deeply some of the causes. That just simple mindfulness really allowed me to kind of not only gain a lot of space around that reactivity of anger, but also see into the structure of it, see how it was coming to be created. And seeing that, the mind began to let go of it. I didn't have to let it go. It just began to let go on its own. So these explorations, and in seeing that, that really deepened my confidence. That deepened my sense of trust that, oh, this is possible. This is worth doing. Within the first few months of my practice, it's like, yeah, I'm going to keep doing this. I see how this benefits. This benefits my life. So it actually doesn't take very long if we're just willing to engage, explore these practices. So the Four Noble Truths are really pragmatic teachings. You know, he's not asking us to believe things. There is some faith that's required, some sense of, you know, engagement that's required, a willingness to engage, a willingness to explore, a willingness to perhaps suspend our habitual, well, how's that going to work, and simply give it a try, run the experiment. That kind of faith is necessary, but I don't think of it as faith in something that can't be tested. And for me, it's like, well, let me run the experiment. Let me see what happens. And then those experiments yield results, give validation. So the process of exploring these Four Noble Truths reinforces itself and deepens, our understanding deepens over time. So I'm one page into my 8-page notes. let's stop here. Yeah. Why don't you pass the mic.
I was just curious about his early life when you were talking about it, that he went out on his own to seek the answers to the question, that he went kind of on his own back to his own memories.
Mm-hmm.
Was there a prevalent religion or other kind of thought at the time that had answers to those questions?
The meditation technology was what was really happening in the time of the Buddha. And it was very active. There was a lot of people searching at that time. And some people felt like they had found some answers, and he went to those teachers. But in his view, they hadn't found the answer that he was looking for.
So there was no church or institutionalized
I don't know about institutions. There were a lot of teachers that had collected a lot of people around them, and those teachers had kind of formalized things. I think like Jainism is one of them that is a religion even today. That was in the forming stages at the same time that the Buddha was around. And so they would get together, all of these different teachers would kind of get together and have debates about, you know, their teachings and understandings. You know, I think it was a time in the history of people, in the history of humanity, that these questions really kind of came to the surface, I think. So I think, and I think even Hinduism was kind of in the same, the beginning of Hinduism was kind of in the same time frame. So I think it was all kind of in formation at the time. Yeah. Although there could be one that I'm not familiar with, but of the ones I know, they were in formation. Yeah. And could you pass the mic?
So my question has to do with all suffering is caused by clinging. I can see that for certain sufferings, you know, because we want something that's really not important, wanting a big house, you know, something that's not important. But what if the suffering is caused by something that we need and we don't get? You know, for example, people abuse us, you mm-hmm. know, treat us with mm-hmm. disrespect. Mm-hmm. So in this case, what is the thing that we should let go?
So that's a great question, and you know the thing. How should I begin? To some extent, yeah. Page two, because that is the next part of the exploration. Is I really wanted to go into this question of dukkha. What is it? But I'll save page two for next week. But you know, the suffering of things happening to us, like, you know, abuse, the actual pain of the abuse is not what the Buddha said is going to go away, right? I mean, if somebody is torturing somebody else or harming them physically in some way or mentally, emotionally, that part is not going to go away. And as a child, abused as a child, you know, these teachings, I think, the earliest documented stories give the possibility of a seven-year-old becoming fully awakened. I don't know whether that's true or not, but, you know, that's kind of mind-blowing if it's true. But, you know, younger than that, you know, what comes to you, you're going to be in the mode of, you know, reacting and trying to get out of the situation in whatever way. I mean, you know, the stories of abuse, I know some can turn, some kids at that young age can turn to a kind of mental escape, which leads to a mental, you know, mental patterns that are difficult to deal with later in life. So once we, if we kind of get out of the abusive situation, I mean, so that the teaching would not be things as they are abuse. It would, you know, it's like compassion for yourself to get yourself out of that abusive situation. As an adult, the way that you have been harmed by that is kind of carried along. And the suffering that we experience, like, in retrospect, almost. It's not in retrospect because it's happening now. Suffering happens now. You know, whatever we are, whenever we are suffering, this is kind of a key recognition, whenever we are suffering, there's something happening right now that is creating that experience of suffering. So that's the piece that the Buddha found, and the piece that he said, you know, this is subtle. How are people going to understand this? You know, that it's in the moment that there is a clinging or craving for something or a reaction to something. So, for instance, you might, you know, just be, you know, walking down the street and see somebody that has a body shape of somebody that had abused you in the past. And boom, the mind instantly is in the space of fear, of of pain, of reactivity, because of that kind of connection. And you may not even see that. You may not even see that happen. You just feel the kind of arising of that history in the moment. And it kind of feels like, you know, history is coming in and visiting us. But it's coming in into the present moment. You know, it's arising because of thoughts in the present moment. It's arising, sight in the present moment produces a memory, produces a reaction to the memory. So the what we learn to let go of is the reaction to the arising of memory. You know, if you're in an abusive situation, then you know we need to get ourselves out of that. If you're no longer in that abusive situation, but suffering from the pain of memories of habitual reactions that have been conditioned in around that, you know, we learn as we're children. You know, we learn ways to deal with people. And if our models aren't so helpful, then what we've learned will maybe not be so skillful in as an adult. And so we begin to, through exploring, through mindfulness, begin to see where is it that we're reacting, where is it that we're holding, where is it that we're, you know, it's easier if I come into a particular example. So in that example of seeing somebody that reminds you, that's triggering the memory in the moment, that happens so fast usually that it's like we don't have, it seems like there's no possibility for there to be a decoupling between a memory and a reaction and a being kind of pulled into a spiral of emotional chaos around that abusive history. It feels like it just happens like that, and there's no space for that, for there to be any other option. And yet what we do find, and what I've seen in my own mind, my own practice, is that that mindfulness, the continuity of mindfulness, the being with experience, the willingness to meet our experience as we can, begins to kind of lower what I would think of as a subconscious horizon. You know, we kind of think, okay, there's things happening below the conscious level of our minds, and there's no way to penetrate that subconscious terrain. Mindfulness can penetrate that subconscious terrain. It actually can. We can see where this whole process unfolding. So we might be able to seeing this person, seeing the memory arise, and then recognizing that the memory is creating our reactivity. So it's the thing that would need to be released in that moment is not the memory, even. We don't even have to suppress the memory, but the thing that it can be released in that moment, not easy to release, but can be released, is the reactivity to that arising of a thought around the abusive history. So much of our suffering around things that have happened is happening, it's happening again to us. It's almost like we're re-traumatizing ourselves by having the thought and then reacting to it. And it's not something like, usually we don't have control over that. It's a pretty deep thing. But the mindfulness can allow us to begin to see. We get a little tiny bit of space around that. We can see, oh, that's a thought. That's just a thought. That's all it is. And then the reactivity to that does not have to follow. So it's, and that's kind of a short answer to your question. See if there's more that I could elaborate on or say there. Would you want to say more?
I guess you answer my question at the beginning. You say that, you know, if you are experiencing suffering because somebody is harming you,
then get yourself out of it.
It's the, yes. You know, the thing is to be compassionate to yourself and to
yes, get absolutely. Out of it. Okay. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. And there will be kind of lingering effects from that trauma. And that's a lot of our work, you know, letting go of the lingering effects. And that is absolutely possible to let those go. It takes time, it takes patience, it takes learning our own minds and seeing where, you know, sometimes with mindfulness of patterns, you know, traumatic patterns like that, the traumatic pattern can be stronger in a way than our ability to be mindful. And it can feel like the mindfulness is just swamped. And, you know, even trying to be mindful of those kinds of strong experiences can, like, suck us into a black hole. And so we need to learn for ourselves, okay, you know, this one right now is not so helpful. I need to not pay attention to that. I need to turn to something else in my experience. And what I found helpful in that kind of a situation is to turn to something neutral. Just notice feet on the ground, sensations of hands, experience of hearing, you know, just something really neutral to allow the mind to kind of settle down if the mind feels like it's overwhelmed by a pattern. So unfortunately, I can't take your question tonight because it's 9 o'clock. So if you'd like, you can. I'm happy to stay for a few minutes and you can come up and ask it. So to be continued. I'll continue next week. Thank you.